Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of economic events, trends in our incomes, our debts, our jobs, future for our kids. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been an economics professor all of my adult life, and I teach currently at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, a remarkable and courageous source of daily news and analysis. I really do urge you to take a look at truthout.org. If you're interested in the kinds of analysis we produce here, please consider making use of our two websites, where we produce much more material to expand on the points we make here, to provide links, classes, interviews, audio and video files of all sorts, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info are these two websites. Both of them, in addition to being freely available 24/7, provide you with ways to send us your questions, comments, criticisms, suggestions. We read every single one of them, I can assure you of that. And we use them to shape the programs and indeed also to answer the questions that we consider at the end of each program. Please bear with us and understand. We are very happy to get a flood of your comments and questions, but we can only answer a few selected ones and ask that you understand the limits that a program of 55 minutes faces. Finally, we ask you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest as well. Before beginning today's program, I wanted to answer a question that one of you sent me, and to tell you that we're currently broadcast on 15 stations across the United States. We're very proud of having grown from 1 to 15 in literally a year and a half, and we welcome each and every one of you. A new station is about to join us, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, but it is extraordinarily gratifying for me and the whole team that produces this program to get the kinds of responses and the kinds of interest that you all have shown in what we're trying to do here. Okay, let's turn then to the updates. I really can't desist today from mentioning something that has caught quite a bit of attention over the last two or three weeks, so I won't repeat it. But two states in the United States voted last year to begin allowing the regular sale of recreational marijuana, the states of Washington and Colorado. And Colorado opened the stores for that on the 1st of January 2014. And I think it is remarkable that this represents the public acceptance in those two states of buying and selling something that had been proscribed before, something that many Americans had thought unthinkable before, is now saleable publicly and legally in those two states. Interestingly, it remains illegal in the United States at the federal level to do what is being done in Colorado and will shortly be done in Washington. But the federal government has announced it will not make any effort to undo or to contest what the law and the people of those two states have decided. And I thought it was also interesting that the initial estimates in Colorado were that the sales of recreational marijuana would generate, they estimate, about $67 million in new revenue to the state of Colorado, money available for that state to do what it does for its people. I want to talk about the recovery, because much is being made in the United States and other parts of the world politically by leaders who need to put as good a face as possible on their careers and on their aspirations. We keep hearing endless conversations about recovery. And I wanted to put this in a certain context. First of all, in many dimensions, we have no recovery. That is, we remain very depressed compared to levels of income and many other measures, what they were in 2007 before this crisis hit. That's clear, and I've reported on that, and I'm not going to repeat myself. What I want to do is talk about what others, those who want us to believe in a recovery, what they're saying. And here's the biggest number. The GDP, the gross output, which, by the way, is this simply a measure of the goods and services produced? It doesn't measure who gets them. So it's possible that our GDP has risen. And indeed, the number since 2007 is currently 0.5%. Please keep that in mind. The United States economy is now 0.5% more productive than it was in 2007. We finally caught up, having lost 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 6 years of production where we didn't grow at all. We're barely above what we were. So we have recovered output, even if that output is much more unequally distributed. And people in the United States like to point out that this is better than other advanced economies who have declined, whose output, for example, and this is mainly Europe, is down 7% compared to what it was 6 years ago. How do we put that in a context? Well, first let's compare it to other countries, our recovery. Because after all, the economic crisis was global in its spread and its impact. The Korean economy, South Korea, the Korean economy compared to 2007 is up 20%. And the People's Republic of China, a society that is run by a communist party, a powerful modern economy, they're up compared to 2007, 90%, 90. By comparison, the United States is up 0.5%. This is not close, friends. This is not a recovery in the United States about which a lot of crowing should happen. It's a situation in which we have 6 years during which we didn't grow at all. 6 years during which we could have, had we put our people to work, produced a vast output of wealth, measurable in the many trillions of dollars. We lost those 6 years. We didn't produce anything extra. We forced millions to languish in an unemployment they didn't want. We left our tools, equipment, and raw materials idle to rust and dust. We did without an output that could have helped us solve countless problems of our own society and of countless societies around the world. We have paid a stupefying price. And to call all of that a recovery when we're 0.5% ahead of where we were in 2007, and when we can look at China and it has grown 90% across that time, and to talk glibly about a recovery is astonishing. The next update for today has to do with a topic I don't deal with regularly: food, dieting, weight. I was struck by a new book. The author is Deborah Cohen. She's a scientist who works for the RAND Corporation, a very conservative, mainline, mainstream research and advice company. And she wrote a new book with a title I'm going to read to you now: A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Forces Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. And this was the subject of a very interesting article in the Washington Post toward the end of December of 2013. And here's what author Cohen tells us. Obesity as a problem, people seriously overweight, doubled between 1980 and 2000. And so the question she addresses, and as many have, is what's behind this? And the reason this is an economic problem is that it has a lot to do with certain industries doing well and others not. It is increasing the medical costs we all have to bear through Medicare and Medicaid and our own private medical bills, because obesity is associated with countless medical problems. So this is an economic issue as well as a personal health issue and so on. Author Cohen goes through a very interesting exercise. She points out that this is not a problem of our genes, because our gene structure didn't change dramatically between 1980 and 2000, but obesity doubled. So this is not in your genes. She says it's also not a lack of self-control. Lots of experiments that she cites indicate that this is not about your self-control. Many measures of self-control have been looked at and are not correlated at all with extra eating. She says also it's not about sedentary lifestyle. She develops information that we are active in different ways, but we are active the way we were 20 years ago. We are not suddenly stopped being active, despite all the jokes about couch potatoes. And finally, she says it's not a matter of education. She enjoyably points out that huge percentages of doctors and of nurses, doctors it's 44%, nurses it's 55%, are obese and overweight. In other words, these are the best educated about the costs and dangers of obesity, but they suffer from the problem as well. So then, what is the explanation that Deborah Cohen brings forward? And this is the one I want to bring to your attention. She says that it has to do with an unremitting, unrelenting barrage of advertisement and promotion of profitable foods that cater to tastes for fat, salt, and sugar. And she drives that point home with statistics and anecdotes and health reports in a remarkable way. And she doesn't shy away from the punchline. And that punchline uses a metaphor, an example. She says at the end of the 19th century, Americans were sick and dying in ways that were traced to the quality of the water that we drank. And when the government stepped in and imposed strict regulations, forcing the development of reservoirs, forcing the development of clean and monitored piping systems to bring reservoir-protected water into our cities and into the taps in our homes, magical improvements in health and well-being resulted. And her argument is, we ought to do the same for our food. We have known unhealthy, damaging food, cheap, fast food, disposable food, food made like with a chemistry set that looks and reads like a chemistry set, that panders to our transient appetites instead of our need for good, balanced nutrition and health. And that if we controlled the food flow with the same high standards that we applied to the water flow, we would deal with obesity and countless other problems that hamper the economic well-being of our society. Interesting. Last update, short update for today before we get to our major topics, has to do with the French government. This is a story that I have been monitoring for some months, even for most of last year, in fact. The socialist government in France, led by François Hollande, came into office promising to raise taxes on the super rich in France. It tried to do that by imposing a 75% top tax rate on the richest French people. Those who earn $1.3 million a year or more, roughly. Now, how does that compare to the United States? The top rate in the United States is 39.6%. So to hit the really rich with a 75% tax rate sounds like a much more daring act than other countries have had. And indeed, it is outstanding among advanced countries right now. Well, the effort of the socialist government was shot down when a French court declared the first effort at it unconstitutional, and that had to then go back into the National Assembly and the Senate in France, and a reworked version of that law has now passed judicial review and will be applied by the French government. So it will tax the super rich at a rate of 75%. And it is going to use that to ease the tax burden on middle and lower income French people. And, just as important, says the government, to maintain the services that the French government provides its people. And it listed in one of their statements some of those services, and I thought you would all be interested to know what they are. Free higher education. Basically, people in France who go to a higher education, to a university, pay a nominal amount of money. It is basically a French notion that higher education, college and university education, should not be expensive, should be provided by the government as a basic social service. Let me pause a moment so that can sink in. Number two, the French government provides subsidies for children. That's right. If you have more than one child, you get a subsidy from the state for the food, clothing, shelter, and raising of your children. You might call this a family values support of the French government for its citizens. Number three, the French government prides itself on providing funds for the beautification of cities, particularly the planting of shrubbery and flowers in cities, and part of the money to be raised from taxing the rich will go for that. The French have a national health service, and so the government pays for that, much of that, and that will be funded too. So you get a sense of the kinds of expenditures the state will provide to the mass of its people, paid now in part by a top tax bracket of 75% on those earning over $1.3 million, almost twice the rate of the American wealthy of that class. Last point, not to be ever forgotten. In the United States, we didn't always charge the rich as little as we do now, 39.6%. In the 50s and 60s, as I cannot desist from saying repeatedly, the top tax rate in the United States was 91%, dwarfing what the socialist president of France is doing. Even in the 1970s, it was 71%, or roughly what the French socialist president is doing. So the French are doing what the United States used to do. Let me turn now to the larger topics that we have chosen for today, and again to remind you, as we do, that these topics are chosen in good part because you've asked for them to be chosen. Here I want to express my thanks, before I do, to the blog of Kathleen Geyer, which I found to be particularly useful to talk about global inequality for a while with you today. Global inequality is measured by something called the Gini coefficient, G-I-N-I. And basically, that's a number that measures the distance between poor and rich in any society, the inequality of income. And here's some statistics that Kathleen Geyer brought together that I thought you would be interested, as I was, in thinking about. The two most unequal countries, that is, the two most countries inside of which inequality is the most extreme in terms of the gap between the lowest income and the highest, are South Africa and Brazil. Countries, by the way, in which there has been sharp and extreme conflict over inequality in the last year. Notice that correlation. The least unequal countries are the Scandinavians and two countries from Eastern Europe, Slovenia and the Czech Republic. And I'll let you think about why that might be. The most unequal regions of the world, the most unequal region, Latin America, where there are the most extreme. The least unequal, North America, Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. But there are exceptions. Russia, the United States, and China are exceptionally unequal when compared to other countries of their same level of development. Wow. Here's something interesting. From the Industrial Revolution, 18th century, through to World War II, global inequality worsened. That is, the gap in the world between rich countries and poor countries got worse. Now, I want to drive something home about this. The Industrial Revolution was also the beginning of the dominance of capitalism, first in Western Europe and eventually spreading to pretty much the whole world by World War II. In other words, the spread of capitalism was likewise the spread of global inequality. Capitalism and inequality go together, contrary to the propaganda that sometimes wants to make us believe that capitalism is some sort of equalizer. It has not been an equalizer. It has, in fact, gone together with global inequality between rich countries and poor countries. After World War II, this sort of changed. The inequality among countries, rich country versus poor country, hasn't gotten worse. But the inequality inside countries has. And so global inequality hasn't changed much. It's changed its shape, but not its overall condition of inequality. Inequality among nations hasn't gotten worse. But inequality inside nations has gotten worse. We are therefore not a world that is suddenly encountering inequality. We are actually a world in which inequality has been a deepening problem, both across nations and more recently within nations. You will not be surprised, therefore, to learn that China produced more millionaires last year than the United States in terms of new millionaires. This is in a country where the extremes of wealth and poverty, therefore, have become more pronounced, even though the distance between China and the United States, for example, has become narrower. So these two, in a sense, offset each other. That is why I said we haven't gotten worse since World War II in the relationship between rich and poor countries, but we have gotten worse in the relationship inside countries in general between rich and poor. And so that is true in China, which is a rapidly growing society, and in Europe and North America, in which the economic growth, as we pointed out earlier today, has been much more modest. The second major issue I want to raise today, and we'll begin before taking our mid-program break, has to do with the notion of a guaranteed annual income. This is an idea that has been around for a long time. The notion that we might be better off, rather than providing countless specific programs, food stamps, housing subsidies, medical insurance subsidies, tax relief of one kind or another, if instead of that, we just said, look, let's guarantee to everybody in a society a certain minimum annual income that they will get by virtue of being a citizen of this country that will be enough to provide them with their basic needs of food, clothing, shelter, education, and so forth. Wouldn't that be more efficient? And wouldn't that be more socially beneficial? And this issue, which has been around a long time, has now gotten new urgency because of what has happened in Switzerland. And that process, which I've reported on once before, has now taken several new steps. First, the basic facts. Under Swiss law, if you can get 100,000 people to sign a petition, and remember, Switzerland is a small country, few million of population, so 100,000 is an enormous part of the population, relatively speaking, to sign up for something. And the people who circulated the petition for an annual national guaranteed income for all Swiss citizens had to raise 100,000. They raised about 126,000 late last year, 2013. And that forces a ballot, a referendum, where all Swiss voters will be able to vote yes or no. It'll take some time, probably 2 or 3 years, to work out the details so it can be put to a vote. They have that time to do that. The numbers that have been brandished around are in the neighborhood of $30,000 per person per year. And so I wanted to raise the question of what this would do and what are the pros, the cons, what is at stake in even thinking about such a thing and in the movement to it. Before I get to that, let me at least underscore what is crystal clear, which is that the Swiss people, like so many in other countries, are reacting against the extremes of wealth and poverty that have emerged. The very inequality I talked about a few minutes ago is showing up, even inside such middle-class societies, such comfortable societies as Switzerland. The Swiss were outraged to discover the kinds of salary packages big corporations were giving themselves and their top executives. There were scandals about that earlier in 2013. It led to the passing of a referendum allowing shareholders to rigidly control, much more than they could before, how high the salaries of executives would go. It led to the referendum on a maximum range between top and bottom payments. That referendum was defeated by the Swiss voters, but it was a clear sign of the extent to which the Swiss people are angry and are determined to do something about what they perceive to be a dangerous trend in modern capitalism, namely to produce extraordinary extremes of inequality. And these views of the Swiss citizens are simply a symbol, a sign of what is happening in other ways and expressed in other ways in so many other countries where the capitalist drive towards inequality is underway and has been for many decades. The question is whether the problem of a guaranteed, or the solution, if you like, of a guaranteed annual income gets at the problem, solves the problem, or perhaps to say it differently, what problems does a guaranteed annual income solve, and what problems does it leave in place? When we return after our short mid-program break, that's the question I will begin by focusing on. Please stay with us as we continue to examine the economic events of our times and the inequality crisis that is looming so much more powerfully around us these days.
What's the matter, can't you hear? Ain't about nothing except an old John Deere. I'm gonna give me old John Deere, old model 60.
Welcome back, friends. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. We are now entering the second half of today's program. We will continue in a moment with our discussion of guaranteed annual incomes as an idea in general and as something that the Swiss people have put on their own agenda for a referendum in the near future. Once again, I want to remind you that if this program and our analyses interest you, please take a look at our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, for a great deal of additional material that we think will be of interest to you, as well as providing you with ways to comment on, send questions to, and so on, in relationship to this program, which we welcome. Okay, so before the break, we were talking about a guaranteed annual income. So let me first talk about the kind of obvious benefits it has. In almost all advanced capitalist countries, and indeed in many countries, the inability of the economic system to generate adequate standards of living for huge numbers of its people, either by the failure of capitalism to provide enough jobs or the failure of the economic system to spread the wealth in a fairly reasonable way so that the bottom half of the population can have a decent life, produces a patchwork of programs that are built up over time through complicated political maneuvers and compromises. So you have a program that provides food subsidies, or a program that provides emergency medical care, or a program that helps with school fees, or a program that gives retirement benefits. A whole host of programs designed, as some say, to redistribute the income and the wealth in society, to compensate for what capitalism does to the mass of people by giving them some sort of support, and to take away from the richest some of the enormous wealth and income they have taken for themselves in order to care for those at the bottom. And by the way, the old debate is, of course, always going on between those who argue that this is humane and those who argue that whether or not it's humane, if the rich want to hold on to their wealth, they better pay something to take care of those at the bottom, because if they make the lives of those at the bottom too awful, there will be a movement to take the wealth away from those who have it. And then, of course, there are those who say, no, we don't have to do that. We need not do that. Maybe we even shouldn't do that. And you get the kind of stretch arguments that suggest that by keeping large numbers of people poor, you provide some bizarre incentive for them to do something, which, of course, the long history of poverty makes ridiculous. But nonetheless, these debates continue. So, and the programs are the results of these debates. So, of course, it is monumentally inefficient. And one of the arguments for a guaranteed annual income is that if we did that, we would do away with the vast waste of money, time, resources devoted to administering and checking and monitoring and inspecting 50 different programs, none of which would be necessary if we simply gave a certain minimum income to these people and then let them spend it as they need to for their food, clothing, shelter, medical care, education, and so on. So there's a kind of argument from efficiency, an argument from simplicity, an argument for getting rid of wildly excessive government bureaucracy to do something that could and should be done much more simply and much more efficiently. There's even an argument that it's more decent. That is, instead of making individuals come and ask for, beg for help with this problem, that problem, give them a decent income so they don't have to be humiliated by coming for each and every expenditure, because they've basically got the money to go out there and buy what they need, when they need it, and for themselves. That argument clearly has some merit, and that's probably how it's going to be fought out in Switzerland. I want to raise a different kind of question about the whole idea. While I understand and sympathize, of course, with those who are horrified by the level of inequality we now tolerate, by the side-by-side existence of extraordinary, if not obscene, wealth, with mass deprivation and poverty. While we can see the growth of the appeal that this is wrong and inappropriate, not just in Switzerland, but the obvious effort of the new mayor of New York City, William de Blasio, to say that he's going to do something about the fact that New York City, in large parts of itself, has become unaffordable to anybody who isn't rich, that the level of rents that are being charged or home prices or condo prices that are being charged make the city a place for wealthy people, period. Or if you want to go to the other extreme, that in a city of extraordinary wealth, there are also, for example, in the borough known as the Bronx, unspeakable poverty, literally a stone's throw from unspeakable wealth, that this is not the way a city ought to be. This is not the way economic development ought to be allowed to pursue a course that is so antisocial in its implications. So we see an opposition to this inequality all over the place, and I sympathize with it. But my quarrel, my question for those interested in a guaranteed annual income is this. Are you not dealing here with an opposition to the result or the symptom without dealing with the underlying cause, the underlying problem, the underlying disease, if we stay with the medical metaphor? Here's what I mean. You have an economic system that is organized in such a way that in enterprise after enterprise, a large number of people come to do the work. 9 to 5, 5 days a week, they come and they do the work. Their muscle, their brains put together a product, a good or a service, for the employer who hires them, who then sells the product. The employer pays the workers their wages and gathers into his own hands the profit, the difference between the value of what those workers have created and what it costs the employers to get them to come there to create it. The profits have been growing. That's how capitalism works. The employer has every incentive to minimize the costs of production and every incentive to maximize how much he can get for it. And the gap between what he gets and what it costs is his profit. So you have a system driven to maximize the profits. This system has worked well and produced stunning profits for the employer class, the shareholders, and others who gather into their hands these profits. If you do nothing about that system, you're leaving in place the system that produces inequality. And then if what you do is tax those at the top to create the money that can then be parceled out to offset the inequality by helping middle and lower income people with their housing or their education or their medical care, whatever it is, this is a very strange way of solving a problem. As with a doctor who says, this is a symptom, I've got to go to the underlying problem, so it is with an economic analysis. You don't just deal with the symbol, the end result, the unequal society. You deal with the economic structure that produces such inequality. You've got to do something about this issue of profit. Who gets the profit? And what do they do with it? If all the workers together, as I say so often on this program, if all of the workers who together produced the profit were together to decide what to do with it, they, of course, wouldn't distribute tiny number of people all of it or most of it and create absurd wealth. They wouldn't do it. They would distribute it much more equally. Then we wouldn't have the problem. We wouldn't have the problem. One of the things they could decide to do is to find useful work for all the people that are unemployed, because that's the logic, and nobody wants there to be unemployment anyway. These are not complex ideas when you get to the basics of it. Moreover, if you don't, if you continue, even with a guaranteed income, what will you have done? You're going to create a guaranteed income that will have to tax the rich or the middle to take care of all those who otherwise wouldn't earn an income. That's going to make for tensions on the part of the middle and particularly the rich. The rich are going to use their wealth to evade, weaken, and undo the guaranteed income. How do I know that? Because that's what they've done with every other program that was ever developed. That's why we're now discussing cutting Social Security. That's why we're now discussing cutting food stamps, which we already did. The people who have it use their wealth to prevent it being taken from the others. You've left in place the economic system that produces the unequal wealth that will forever resist and undermine whatever social welfare program you have, whether it's the patchwork quilt system we now have or the guaranteed minimum income alternative that is being considered in Switzerland and is being debated more widely, particularly in Europe. Why do this? Why plague a society with all the conflicts of redistributing income when you could get rid of all of that by simply distributing it differently from the beginning? Don't allow some people to have more than 5, 6, 7 times what other people get. That's a big enough gap. More than enough. It's enough to recognize if you believe some people are more skilled than others, some people are more important to support than others. Whatever view you have, let it be understood that you single out, you reward, whatever word you like, those who you think ought to be rewarded more, but you limit the amount of difference so we don't have a society of extremes and all of the social conflicts and tensions. That we don't have a society that makes some people so rich and others so abjectly despondent that we have to have either an immense bureaucracy to offset this inequality or a guaranteed income that then becomes the object of endless maneuver and struggle and tension and waste of energy and waste of resources and undermining of whatever community spirit we can hope to hold our societies together. That's the ultimate question, and that is not addressed by the notion of a guaranteed annual income. We come now to the last portion of our program where I deal with questions that some of you have sent in. Let me begin this one with a question about credit unions. Credit unions are basically a kind of people's alternative to banks. It's a way for people who have money they want to put in a bank-type institution, and for people who want to be able to get loans from such an institution, but would rather it be nonprofit, would rather it be geared to serving the depositor and the borrower without serving anybody else in the process. In other words, it's folks have developed credit unions who would like to do nonprofit banking and have it more responsive to themselves, without there being a group of people who are investors whose interest is drawing a profit out of the bank rather than having a place for deposits and loans. Credit unions are very big in the United States, and they're even bigger in many, many other countries. They are like an alternative to the banking system, the private, profit-driven banking system. In that way, credit unions are like what I talked about a couple of weeks ago, the Bank of North Dakota, which is the one public bank chartered and organized by a state, namely North Dakota, in the United States, which is also an alternative to private banking. As I explained then, the state of North Dakota takes all the money that comes in taxes and fees and license payments, and deposits it not in a private bank, but in a state bank, which then makes loans to the people of North Dakota. Therefore, no profit has to be earned, or if a profit is earned, the profit is folded back into the accounts of the state of North Dakota and means that they don't have to tax their people as much because they use the profit of the bank, all of it, to take care of the state's activities, something they couldn't possibly do if the bank were private. So we have credit unions all across the United States, and we do in other countries. They stand as a constant alternative to private banks. Bigger credit unions in the United States, for example, offer all the same services that a bank does. Credit cards, mobile app banking from your cell phone, all kinds of loans, you name it. There's really nothing computer-wise that a credit union can't do and is doing compared to a private bank. So in a way, it's a way of removing the bank activity from the imperatives and the drives of profit-making and has been extremely popular with millions upon millions of people who use credit union instead of a bank. Unfortunately, that also means that there's endless warfare. The private banks feel threatened by the credit unions, particularly these days when the reputation of large private banks like Bank America and Wells Fargo and Citibank and J.P. Morgan Chase and so on are at such a low level because of their fines they've been paying, for money laundering, for excessive fees, for manipulating interest rates, foreign exchange rates, the mortgage crisis. You put it together, private large banks are very unpopular. This would therefore be the prime time for credit unions to become that much more appealing. And this reality is not lost on the big private banks, so there's a struggle going on, as there has been for many, many years. And the big private banks try to limit what credit unions can do, to keep them small, to keep them hemmed in, to exclude them from all kinds of banking where they would like to go, to limit them in every which way, and to take away some of their tax advantages. And the credit unions have to fight hard with many fewer resources against the private banks, who can throw in huge amounts of money. Not lost on anyone, I hope, is the reality that part of the resources that the big private banks can throw into squeezing the credit unions is the bailout money and support that the federal government, we, you and I, provided to Washington, which it in turn used to bail out those private banks. Their ability to go to economic war against the credit unions is actually financed by the taxpayer, who would be much better served if the credit unions were allowed to expand and offer more competition than the private banks wish to allow. It is another example, in short, that the celebration of competition is for speeches at the Rotary Club twice a year, not for the reality of how American capitalism works. The big banks do not want competition from credit unions and do much in their power to limit or destroy it. The second question that we have time for today has to do with Europe and the United Kingdom, a question that I talk a little bit more about the economic problems they have. Well, I think in many ways what we discuss about the United States does apply to Europe and the United Kingdom, particularly the United Kingdom, which patterns itself in many ways after the United States. But I think we have to face a couple of realities. First, that the economic crisis, which started in the United States, has now migrated to Europe and done more damage in Europe than it did here in the United States. It's interesting to speculate why that is, but it is the case. Partly it has to do with the fact that Europe is still many little countries, not one big one. It's moving towards becoming one big one, and if it does continue, it will become a bigger one than the United States, and that is clearly the dominant desire of the capitalist classes in those countries. On the other hand, it has a long way to go to overcome all of the national differences. So that's one big effect. Secondly, as I said, the economic crisis is having a greater impact. The interaction between the unification process, in which the major driver is Germany, with its own idea of what a unified Europe should look like, namely a lot like Germany, is pressuring the austerity programs on the rest of Europe. Not that the rest of Europe is not in many cases quite willing to go along, and particularly when the rough edges can be blamed on the Germans, and so there's a complicated cat-and-mouse game being played there. But nonetheless, the combination of a unification effort with an economic crisis drives the particular dynamic of that part of the world. Third important thing is that the Europeans have a much more developed social safety net. So the irony of Europe is that on the one hand, their mass of people are suffering less, with the exceptions of the Greeks and certain others, but the mass of their people are suffering less because of the social safety net than their counterparts are in the United States, and yet they're in the streets much more protesting. So there's a struggle going on inside Europe about whether and to what extent their safety net is going to be compromised as they struggle their way through. I do think that we're going to see the crisis get worse in Europe. I think that this clash between a dominant capitalist employer class that wants this unification to go through and wants to use this crisis to solidify their position means that they are going to have to, as they are doing, undermine the safety net that was created by workers' struggles starting in the Great Depression, even earlier in some cases, but starting particularly in the Great Depression and building up the kinds of social supports we talked about earlier in this program. The big struggle is between holding on to them and unifying in a situation of crisis. The effort of many is to basically solve the crisis and solve the unification by undermining the social safety net. That is the underlying struggle, I think, will play out and will determine how things evolve in the United Kingdom and in Europe. It will be tense and it will be difficult. In many ways, the Greek situation is a kind of test case and has been since 2010. A test case to see how much of a social safety net you can eviscerate, how much of the working class's wages you can cut in this process of working your way out of a crisis and holding on to your unification project. That's why Greece is such a particularly important player in all of this. I also think that the left has to reform itself if it is going to contest in this process rather than be largely a spectator of it. We have, unfortunately, again, run out of time for this program. I hope, again, that you have found it of interest, that this ongoing effort to develop economic literacy, let's call it economic insights, by providing these regular updates will be a way for the real goal of this program to be reached, namely, that all of you, dear listeners and viewers, that you understand that the economic crisis is here for the long term, and that what has to be done is a movement has to be built, organizations have to be built, that question and transform this economic system as the precondition for solving most of our social problems. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.